yeah, I think it's brilliant to enjoy somebody who perhaps may have done you down over the years to watch them falling arse over tit.
Yeah.
It's just, and if you can't enjoy it and if your mates can't support you in enjoying it, get new mates.
Or ring me and Jane.
Or ring the Janes.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information. Welcome to Off Air on what is, in the real world, Maundy Thursday. It's a drizzly old London Thursday, isn't it?
Very Maundy-ish.
It is actually very, very true. Mulcairns and Garvey for one more time. Next week, you're with La Glover.
Yeah, I'm going to pretend to be you next week.
I know. Which of the two of us do you think you're most like?
Oh, what's the right answer?
I'll leave that one with you. So, Fee is back next week and I'm sure she'll be absolutely bursting to go. We were just talking off air before the microphones went on about the terrible moments in our lives, but also rather beautiful moments in our lives when we get support.
In our schadenfreude.
Yeah, well, in schadenfreude. Because let's be honest, sometimes we delight in the success of others.
Mm.
And at other times, it's just really annoying. Really annoying.
Yeah, sometimes we delight in their failure. And it's very unbecoming. I know it's very unbecoming. Yeah. But just sometimes it's lovely just to have the complete unilateral support of your friends when you're watching someone just fall flat on their face.
Has this happened to you lately?
Possibly quite recently. And it's not a trait I like in myself. And actually, I don't generally feel schadenfreudistic. I've just invented a word.
Schadenfreudistic tendencies.
Yeah, I generally don't. But this past week, I've very much enjoyed watching somebody fail.
Well, I think, Jane, you're extremely honest. It's one of many things I like about you. I mean it, because there are lots of us who would like to be nicer than we actually are.
Are you saying I don't even pretend to be nicer than I am?
To be fair to me, I'm going to be fair to myself, I think I'm quite honest about what I think and feel most of the time. And, yeah, I think it's brilliant to enjoy somebody who perhaps may have done you down over the years to watch them falling arse over tit. It's just, and if you can't enjoy it and if your mates can't support you in enjoying it, get new mates.
Or ring me and Jane.
Or ring the Janes.
We will support you in your schadenfreude.
I should say, this is Maundy Thursday and you are going to hear a guest in Off Air today who I think is really suitable for this time of year. It's the Reverend Kate Botley. She's one of those vicars that even those of us who are not religious can bear. And I don't mean that in any way rudely, I hope, or disparaging of people who find huge comfort in religion. And actually, I know a lot of people who are made better by their faith. You know, they are fundamentally decent people who do a bit for society because of their connection with churches and things. And actually, in the interview, Kate says that if you want to go to church because you just want to be part of a community and you're not actually certain you believe, just do it.
Absolutely.
And I like that idea. I still don't go.
No.
But I like the idea.
I mean, I did go for quite a number of years. Well,
well,
I went to Catholic
school.
And my family would always go to church. And my grandmothers went every day, sometimes twice a day.
Every day?
Every day, yeah.
Were they in Ireland or here?
First in Ireland and then here.
Okay.
So, yeah. Very connected, did lots of things for the nuns. I mainly used to go for the singing. really enjoy a bit of singing. But not enough to go anymore.
It's quite a schedule going once a day or twice a day, isn't it? I mean, what else do you fit in? I suppose there's time.
Ten children. Yeah, and a lot of praying.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Busy, those Irish grandmothers.
Yeah, absolutely. Christine has news about Kling Film. The good news is, shortly before she died in 1989, my mother bought me 200 metres of Lakeland Kling Film with a dispenser. That is a very proud boast. I'm not a frequent user, but this very day, she says, I finished the roll. The bad news is she also bought me a refill and I'm now 77. I've been listening to your advice about making a will. I was wondering if I should include the Kling Film refill for my niece. What do you think? I think the answer is in the affirmative. Yeah. Do include it, Christine.
I wonder if you can have one of those, you know, automatic reorders for the Kling Film.
I think I've been
relatively clean this week, so I'm just going to lower the tone enormously.
Well, go
just
on.
Before we finish.
In the time left.
In
yeah.
the time left. So my only personal anecdote about Kling Film is...
Oh, God. Okay. They're not the same as condoms, bits
no,
of Kling
but
Film.
Because I am a frontline journalist, yes. And, you know, with a very, very serious job, I went to sex camp in Australia some years ago, and...
What is a sex camp?
Well, its official title was Celebrating Sexuality, and it was held on a Girl Guide campground in the bush. I mean, it sort of writes itself, doesn't it? So I was on my way back from my cousin's wedding in New Zealand.
I don't doubt that you still had to write it.
I still had to write it. I was on my way back from my cousin's wedding in New Zealand and heard about sex camp and obviously thought, that's something I should go to and write about. And there were all sorts of classes... sort of spanking workshops and Japanese rope tying, all sorts of other ones. Can we say anything off air? I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to say all of the names of the classes.
Okay.
Because some of them are very rude.
How rude?
Very rude.
Explicit. Okay.
Explicit.
Did the Girl Guides know this was happening, by the way?
I don't know. I didn't see any Girl Guides, so it was all above board and adult.
In that
very
sense.
Very adult in some ways. And they kept sort of saying, it's not a big orgy. It's not a big orgy. And then, of course, on the last night, there was a big orgy.
Oh.
And in one corner where there was a lot of the orgy happening, people were wrapping each other in cling film quite a lot. And, yeah, so maybe that's where the Girl Guide
I don't think
comes
Lakeland
in.
Are going to be... Can I just say, I don't think they want to be associated with this in any way.
There was an awful lot of cling film going on
in
the orgy.
That anecdote was not what Christine expected when she emailed this podcast in good faith asking my advice on whether or not she should leave her Lakeland cling film refill to her niece in her will. And to get back to the point of your email, Christine, the answer is I think you should. Okay, because you're clearly not using cling film at a great rate. So at the age of 77, you could have another 25 years ahead of you.
It's true.
You may finish it, but I'm thinking you probably won't. Anyway.
Mm. Unless you start wrapping other people in it.
Right.
Just a suggestion.
Well, that's Mulcairn suggesting that.
Can I rescue this by talking about baked potatoes?
Please do. Yes, quite. God, moving seamlessly onto the subject of baked spuds.
So Maria has written in saying, you keep saying how long baked potatoes take and how useless they are in a microwave, but Maria begs to differ. Mm. Here's what to do, she says.
Yeah.
Microwave the potato for about 5 minutes, prick to make sure the centre is soft, put the potato in a cereal-sized bowl, drizzle olive oil over the potato and swish it around, then sprinkle it with salt and pepper, put it in a hot oven for 10 to 15 minutes. Maria says, sorry, this is such a boring email, but I hope it opens a quick, easy sub for you. It could not be more boring. I'm into this idea. I've never really thought about putting olive oil over a potato and then putting it in the oven.
No, I haven't. I'm taking that one, Maria.
I mean, it seems like a cross between a baked potato and a roast potato to me.
Yes.
Which I'm definitely up for.
You know, we were talking about spud you like, weren't we?
We were.
That was what inspired this. And by the way, Maria, never apologise for, that is far from a boring email and we're very grateful to you for it. And I'm going to try it. I'm going to put that to one side. I'm going to take the advice home. Spud you like.
I don't have a microwave though, so this is...
Oh, don't you?
Nope.
Ew, I have.
Or a toaster.
I've got a microwave.
In fact, my parents arrived yesterday and my dad yet again complained about my lack of toaster.
Why haven't you got one?
Because I just don't toast things very much. I've got a grill and a very small kitchen. I also don't have a colander, as it was pointed out to me last night. There's many things I don't have in my kitchen.
I don't know. How have you got through life without a colander?
I don't know.
Do you just not drain anything?
Yeah, but with a pan lid.
With a pan lid?
Yeah, if it's in a pan, just drain it with a pan lid.
Oh, you have to be quite dexterous for that.
Yeah. Anyway, I think I'll probably have a colander by the end of the weekend.
I'm feeling that you will. And I worry that, I mean, if I'll try and get you one if you can't get one at the weekend. Because I don't like the idea of you draining things with a pan lid. It's also quite dangerous. You might burn yourself.
I don't do that much cooking. I think that's what I'm going to be really honest about here. In my new radical honesty, I don't do a lot of cooking.
No, because you're having a good time too much of the time. Cam says, spudgy-like. I remember a funny cartoon showing a spudgy-like shop with an overflowing bin outside, and the overflowing bin was labelled spudgy didn't like. Thank you for that. So loads of people are going to be having a baked potato for their tea tonight.
Absolutely.
On drizzled in olive oil. Of this content.
So this email is to Hi Jane and Fee and Substitute Services Jane. Thank you very much.
She's so much more than that.
I don't know.
All right.
You've been talking recently about gentlemen's clubs, says Ema, our lovely listener, and the Freemasons, and whether anything similar exists for women. Coincidentally, says Ema, I've just heard of a court case held last week in Australia in which a women's only space became the focus of a discrimination case. This is really interesting, actually. Artist Kirsha Kachela, I may have mangled that, sorry, the wife of the owner of the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart, Tasmania, developed an art installation at the museum, which is billed as a tremendously lavish space where women can indulge in decadent nibbles, fancy tipples and other ladylike pleasures. Sounds like a place for us. Only those who identify as women can enter the space, except for the male butlers who serve the women. It's getting better and better. When a Mr. Jason Lau visited the gallery, he was denied entry, and he complained to Tasmania's Equal Opportunity Commissioner. At the hearing last week, Kachela stated, I think the rejection of men is a very important part of the artwork. And she says she's delighted this issue was brought to the court as it brings the art to life. So we've also been sent an article here which explains it. And our listener says the theatrics of the case are fabulous. In the hearing, Kachela was flanked by 25 female supporters, all wearing navy suits, red lipstick and glasses. And they left the courtroom dancing out to Simply Irresistible. So I'm going to check out that YouTube clip that she sent us. But I do love this little court sketch of them all.
What was the upshot of the court case, that they could go on operating as they were?
I don't know what the upshot is.
Because I rather like the idea that the fact that men were rejected
is part of the artwork.
It's part of the artwork.
Yeah.
Would that be enough to help the Garrick Club survive in its current form? Could they pretend to be an art installation?
An art installation. Old duffers.
I was saying the other day that I used to reject the advances of other children who wanted me to play out. And I've got a friend, Vicky says, as a child, I was sent to boarding school and therefore had few or no friends locally at home. On one occasion, though, a kindly neighbour must have persuaded her children to pop round and invite me to play out with them. I called downstairs telling my mum to let them know, no thanks, I'm reading a book. How to make friends and influence people, says Vicky. In the 70s, we didn't yet have a spectrum to be on, nor realise the amount of psychological damage caused by sending children away to school. At a later date, I did deign to join the neighbours' children for a game of cowboys and Indians, which was also perfectly acceptable at that time. I was captured, tied to a rotary dryer and left in the garden while they went in for tea. Probably my own fault for being such a dick. In my defence, I knew no better and I still enjoy reading books. Vicky, you keep on reading.
You sound like our kind of girl,
yeah,
Vicky.
Don't worry about it.
Just on the boarding school front, did you hear Nikki Campbell on the radio this morning?
I haven't heard him today talking about it, but
it's incredibly moving.
Yeah, no, it is. I think, you know, I heard him yesterday talking about it, actually, and he said something I thought was really powerful and it really made me think. And he just said, you know, when you abuse small children, I think he actually said in because of his case, when you abuse small boys, do remember they grow up. And they will want to well, actually, they are now able to talk about their suffering and what happened, but you do fear for those many, many generations who I'm sure were abused and weren't able to talk about it. So I just hope, I mean, I really do hope that there's some closure, I don't really like the term, but there's some...
Peace.
Some sort of mental peace in knowing that you have been believed.
Yeah.
And I think justice is probably still going to elude them.
Well, because the man who they have accused, well, the main abuser is dead, isn't he?
Exactly.
So I don't know if you can have real closure when you can never have, you can never be heard by them.
Yeah.
But maybe as you say, being believed in a wider forum,
it's probably not enough,
helpful.
But it's better than nothing.
Mm.
But I mean, I haven't had that experience, thank God. So I don't feel I can speak for them. But I hugely admire all of them. I mean, I know Nikki's been very prominent, but lots of other men have spoken up, spoken out, and just let their pain get out there and made the rest of us aware of what went on.
Absolutely.
And thank goodness they found the strength to do it.
Mm. And support for one another to do it as
well.
I have an apology to make.
Good.
This is a very specific apology about our conversation about America and Americans yesterday or the day before, sometime earlier this week.
Yes.
In which I think our listener is probably correct that we were flagrantly criticising other countries, speaking in generalities, but encouraged by you, Jane Garvey. Oh, you set me up.
Of course, sorry. I've got form there.
You're throwing me under the bus, Garvey.
I don't mean to do it.
I might just withhold my services, my substitute services.
Don't do that.
You can talk on your own. I wouldn't do that.
I wouldn't mind talking on my own.
You know, it's quite annoying, isn't it?
I could get together with Vicky, who doesn't want to play out, and the two of us could just sit here in silence. It'd be perfectly companionable. We could just read.
Reading your books, yeah. So our listener says, when you speak about people from other countries, you speak in generalities and highlight the most banal of stereotypes. While stereotypes have some truth to them, let's be clear, not every American overshares, totes guns, likes Trump, and or thinks healthcare and other social welfare programmes are complete rubbish. And I do absolutely agree with you, Sonali. That is an unfair stereotype. She says, making cheap shots only shows a lack of imagination. Yes, and I do apologise if that is the way we came across. That certainly wasn't my intention. And I'm going to say some of my best friends are American and it sounds trite, but it's true. She also says, if you want Americans to have a global mindset, which we should, start with using your immensely privileged forum to talk about our commonalities rather than our differences. Sure, it might be funny to talk about all the ways that Americans are strange or quirky, but couldn't that be said for any culture? Maybe consider flipping what you're doing. If I, as an American, made the same statements you make about the US, but instead about England, how would you feel? Would you think it was rude or perhaps short-sighted and ignorant? If so, then consider whether your comments should be revised. I know that taking the piss out of sensitive Americans is fun, but it doesn't build community or a global mindset. Quite right. I would just like to say I did have quite a lot of people taking the piss out of me being British.
But what did they say, Jane?
Well, just, you know, emotionally constipated, that kind of thing.
Okay. drink a lot of tea.
Those sort of things, yeah.
But you had your Irishness to fall back on, didn't that protect you?
Do you know what? I never really played that card very hard. But I will say that as a British person in America, you are far more privileged than you are sort of held back by it, because Americans are generally incredibly positive and warm towards Brits. Again, this is a generalisation, but I would meet a lot of people who would sort of automatically assume that, you know, you're quite well bred and well educated just because of your accent. Little did they know.
Yeah. Jane, you're doing yourself down. I thought I had to say that, really.
I'm educated. Let's just say that.
I'm going to do a quick apology.
It is Maundy Thursday,
well,
isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I mean, yes, absolutely. In the conversations which have come out of your interview with Jeff Norcott, the comedian who'd made that documentary about whether or not it was worth going to uni, the subject of contact time on humanities degrees kept on coming up, and I'm getting increasingly frustrated with the humanities students only get 9 hours a week teaching rhetoric. Fees have inevitably instrumentalised students and encouraged them to think in terms of pounds per seminar. seminar. Not, I would add, that this results in higher attendance. In fact, quite the opposite. But the lectures and seminars are not supposed to be the sum total of all the time, the thinking, the research and the engagement that staff and students put in. On a literature degree, what would you have us do? Read 7 novels a week and have seminars for all of them? When would the students actually read the book, digest it, research the critical discussions it's generated? Or should we sit and read the book together, going around the class reading aloud a paragraph each, like we did at school? I've been told there, and you make very good points. I don't need to mention the correspondent's name, but I absolutely get it. And I think actually you're right. There probably was a time during the course of my English degree that I was meant to read up to 7 novels a week, or at least 3 or 4. I don't think I ever managed it. And I actually found that was one of the aspects of doing an English degree I found so hard. I read for pleasure, and reading because you have to still is something
it's a lot,
that I find
that's a lot
tough.
Of books to get through in a week, isn't it?
Yeah.
I studied social and political sciences, and we also had a lot of books to read. I mean, you sometimes have to tear through about 8 books in a week and then write an essay about it and then have a supervision about it. I honestly don't know how I did it now. Looking back, my brain has definitely turned to some level of sort of putrefaction since my degree. But it's a lot of reading, and I don't know how you can actually really analyse it properly at that pace.
You can't.
No.
Unless you're right, and our brains in our late teens and early 20s are just working at an accelerated rate of verging on pure brilliance. But
verging on pure brilliance, fueled by really cheap white wine.
Well, cherry brandy.
Ooh.
That was my tipple.
Cherry brandy.
I used to pop down
by
to
the pint.
Bar. Popped out of the bar in the Hall of Residence, and then you had a pint of cherry brandy.
No, I was asking you.
Oh, no, I just have just a shot of cherry brandy.
A shot of cherry brandy.
I think it cost 50p from memory, and then I'd go up to the room and then I'd put something together.
Wow.
Bear in mind, I'm only 5'1", so that one shot of cherry brandy could have an astonishing
going
impact.
For a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you feel like you did work hard?
No.
Really?
No. And I put it this way, I richly deserved my 2-2. And actually, I was lucky to get it.
Wow.
Not there's anything wrong with getting a third class degree.
A gentleman's degree.
Yes, very much so.
It'll probably get you into the Garrick.
Oh, I too could wear that. What's the colour of the tie they wear? It's really weird, isn't it? And extremely unattractive.
I've got no idea.
I think it's, from memory, I've never been, but I think it's salmon pink and green.
Oh, good Lord.
Properly weird, Jane.
Properly weird.
Yeah.
As it is, the Easter weekend almost is upon us. We have an email here from Mary, who says, "Dear Jane and Fee, many Australians celebrate the Easter bilby, who is an endangered marsupial with an ant and insect diet, rather than the Easter bunny, because rabbits are an environmental nightmare in Australia." Because, it makes mitosis, isn't it?
Yeah.
So she's painted as a little Easter card that celebrates the canny use of Easter eggs to lure ants. It's a lovely little Easter card of the bilbies.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Yeah, thanks, Mary.
And have a very happy Down Under Easter, where I imagine it'll be autumn, won't it?
Yeah, it'll be autumn.
That just continues to blow my mind that other parts of the world have different seasons. Today in the UK, one, I have to say, relatively obscure branch of the NHS has issued a warning suggesting that people shouldn't eat an entire Easter egg in one sitting. Which has led to the typical, the reaction that was absolutely inevitable. "It's a nanny state. I'll eat as many big eggs as I want," said the, inevitable voices who always speak out against this kind of thing.
I tell you, I've had a very busy morning. I only read the headline.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, was it from a calorific point of view or a safety point of view? Were they saying, don't try to open your gullet and force down, enormous egg?
Choking hazard.
Choking hazard.
Also, risk of diabetes. All the usual things. So I think...
I reckon you could get a cream egg down in one.
Do you know what? I really don't like cream eggs.
They're overrated.
They
aren't
are
they?
So sweet. Mm. And they're just... No. I mean, go for something more sophisticated. Mm.
A lint egg?
A nice lint egg. An Hotel chocolate.
So yesterday... It was the joint birthdays of the esteemed Tony Turnbull, food editor of The Times,
and
his deputy Hannah Evans. Well, his is today, but they are born within moments and 30 years of one
another. Each other, yeah.
And how did Marks they mark and Spencer, this? I'm giving Marks and Spencer a big old shout out here because you know I love them. They sent a giant Colin the Caterpillar cake to the office.
I'll tell you what, there's no flies
it's
on them.
Enormous.
How on earth did they think that was a good idea?
Well, it was a very good
idea. Of course it was.
The office was very happy.
Yeah, I bet.
Giant Colin. I mean, it was huge. It was the size of, I'm trying to think what's like a caterpillar, but bigger. It was like a lizard.
A boa constrictor?
With legs.
Mm. It's funny that Marks and Spencer's don't do a gorgeous, high-calorie boa constrictor. But maybe they'll think about it.
Sally the Snake, coming soon.
This is a golden age at M&S. I mean, I've been a loyal customer for many years, but really, they can't do wrong at the moment for me.
No, it's great.
Yeah.
You're just looking for a cake, aren't you? Angling for a giant Colin.
The address is. Of course not. I'm so much better than that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
To our big guest this afternoon, and it's the Reverend Kate Botley, appropriately, as we approach Easter. She's one of Britain's leading showbiz vicars. She's got to be right up there, hasn't she, alongside the Reverend Richard Coles. A star of Gogglebox and Strictly, she now makes regular appearances on Steph's Packed Lunch and Songs of Praise. Her first book, Have a Little Faith, is full of good advice for life, even if you are a raving agnostic. We started our conversation with Easter, so come on, Kate. Can you explain it all to us?
Well, not really, I don't think, because, you know, it's all a bit sort of upside down and back to front, isn't it? I mean, for a start, we call it Good Friday and it's the day he died, for goodness sake. So it's already on a back foot. But I guess, you know, as all sort of good Christian festivals, it's an amalgamation of all kinds of past religions and beliefs and a lovely sort of selection box of different things in there. But what I really like about Easter, in contrast perhaps to something like Christmas, for example, is that it doesn't seem to have kind of got the momentum of commercialism in quite the same way. So that means that we don't have to buy into the chaos and the pressure of it, which I really enjoy. And I think that if you approach Easter as a non-religious person, if that's as much as you get from it, is, well, look, it's chocolate eggs and perhaps a nice lunch, yeah, you know, without any of the sort of stress that other festivals might bring with it, then I think that might be good enough. But for me, I like the most important service for me at this weekend is the one that goes from the darkness of Good Friday. So on Good Friday, I will be spending what's called the hour at the cross. And I will sit in church and I will watch people take away all the statues, cover up all the crosses, take away all the trappings and the trimmings and the flowers, and the church will be empty, will be devoid of any of the sort of glitz and glamour. And then on Easter Sunday morning, a single candle will be carried at the sunrise service while it's still dark. A single candle will be carried into a very dark church. And then all of a sudden, all the candles will be lit. The light will be passed around. The statues will be unveiled. The flowers will be there. And we'll go from a real sense of paring back to a sense of kind of you know, all glitz and glamour for the resurrection. And I think there's something really there for us to take away and learn about. The feast is always better after the fast.
That sounds so beautiful. And
it's gorgeous.
Yeah, I didn't know there was a sunrise service on Easter Day. Has there always
been?
Yeah,
and there's fires. You know, there'll be a big bonfire lit. And it's also an opportunity for those of us who were baptised, who were christened as babies, to renew our baptism vows for the coming year, which is always really powerful.
So Easter is, it's renewal, it's rebirth, and it's a triumph over death? Is it that simple?
Yeah, I think it probably is that simple. I mean, for me as a person of faith who hopes for something after this world, but doesn't live always anticipating it. You know, I think that sometimes as people of faith, we have this idea that, oh, it'll all be better once we're dead. Well, I'd quite like it to be better while I'm alive, please. Thank you very much. So, you know, I don't sort of live my life eagerly waiting for my own death. But as someone who's recently been through a massive bereavement with my mum, you know, it brings extra poignancy. Last year, everybody sort of gathers round those people who are grieving at Easter and, you know, sort of cuddles them and softens it all. But this year, you know, people have stopped saying, I'm sorry, your mum's dead. Mm-hmm. So it feels even, you know, I always think the second year of grieving is even harder than the first.
That's something that people need to bear in mind, isn't it? That it hasn't, the pain and the grief has not gone 12 months on. It's just not like that.
And neither should it. Neither should it. You know, I mean, I think someone once said that grief stays the same size, but other stuff gets bigger around it. And one of the chapters I'm most proud of in the book is the chapter on death. The one that I've got the most kind of conversation out of and the most feedback from is where people have just wanted to talk about their own experience of grief, which is not a new experience for me. I only need to walk into a pub and people go, can I tell you about my dead mother? And I go, yes, of course you can. It's a very normal conversation for me, but I know for lots of people it isn't. But of course, Easter is the festival as a Christian. And I pin my hopes on, I put my money on this not being all there is to the world.
With your mum, there was a lovely idea in the book, which I think we'll pass on because I think it's a great one for other people to try. You had cards printed with your mum's face on, and you asked people who were kind to you to take a card and then take your mum on a trip.
Yeah, she's had a wonderful time. She's better travelled in death than she ever was in life. She's had some wonderful celebrations and parties. She's been skiing. She's been to the Raffles Hotel for cocktails. She's got lost in the back of a taxi in Thailand. We don't know what's happened to her there, but she's having a great time. Yeah, they're just, because what happens is people say, I'm really sorry. In the early days of your grief, people will say, I'm really sorry for what's happened. And of course, then there's that moment where you don't know what else to do with the exchange, because that you say, they go, I hear your mum died. You go, yes. And they go, I'm really sorry. And then where do you go in the conversation? So quite often I'd sort of go, can I give you something? And these business, just little kind of, you know, online printed business cards with pictures of my mum on and a date. It's on the back, her name and a date. And I went, this is my mum. And then people would look at the card and they go, oh, you look a bit like her. Or what's happening in this picture? Is this your christening? Or, you know, is this her wedding day? Or whatever the card had on it. And that would spur the conversation along a little bit, and, you know, because people feel really awkward around grieving people. And then I would say, would you do me a favour? Would you take it? And it's entirely up to them what they do with it. I kept it very open and very loose. So some people put her places, you know, left her pinned to notice boards, or some people have got her on their fridge. Some people have got her in their back pocket. And it was a really lovely thing to do, because there's something about that holding something and having an exchange that elevated it, and of course gave them permission as well to talk about their grief.
Did your mum have faith?
Yes, she did. I mean, it was folk religion initially. We were never taken to church as kids, christened as babies. I only started going to church because I fancied the vicar's son at the local church.
Well, you married him.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it worked out, but I wasn't necessarily expecting that. But no, not really. It was very much folk religion stuff, you know, so lots of superstition, lots of, you know, if a coffin went past, you stopped and bowed your head, all that sort of quiet respect for those who, you know, around faith and stuff. But my mum came to faith, found a faith. I mean, I always think faith is a bit like a coat in your wardrobe that you never really wear very often. And sometimes you have to put it on and check it still fits and suits you. And sometimes you grow into it, really. So she had a very bad stint in hospital back in 2016, really bad stint in hospital, and wasn't expected to make it. And when she came out of ICU, she got confirmed and started going to church. And she very much liked anything uplifting. She didn't like it too depressing. She liked things happy, and she liked to come out of church and feel better. And I think that might be enough.
We've been talking on our podcast about funerals and about the importance of funerals and about speaking at funerals. Were you able to conduct your mum's funeral?
No, I didn't conduct my mum's funeral. I got a really good friend to do it. I got her priest to do it, who she really loved, who came to visit her and give her her last rites when she was dying. I did do the eulogy. I did talk about my mum. And what was really interesting is my brother is not a person of faith, and we disagree. I said I won't do my mum's funeral because I don't I pull focus enough, right? I'm the centre of attention enough. I don't want my mum's funeral to be about how brave I've been for doing my mum's funeral. So I didn't do the liturgy, I didn't do the big words, but I did do the eulogy. And my brother said, oh, I thought you weren't doing the funeral, because for him the funeral was the eulogy, and for me the funeral was the liturgy. Was those big words that I say at everybody's funeral, you know, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, ensure and certain hope of the resurrection's life. I could not say those words over my mum's coffin, but I could talk about who she was as a person. So there was a bit of a disconnect there, which was interesting. But I will always encourage family, if they would like to take part in the funeral, they'd like to speak, then it always adds something that a priest with a dog collar on, whoever, a celebrant, whoever's at the front who didn't know the person, just can't add.
Yeah, I mean, I, for what it's worth, I completely agree with you. If you are able, then yeah. How wonderful to be able to do it. That there is a story in the book about one of the funerals you conducted, Kate, for a baby who had been, well, her father had been suspected of killing her. Mm. And I must admit, I read that and it really shook me, because I just thought, you forget sometimes what sorts of positions ministers of all faiths are put in. What was that like?
Well, you go into professional mode is what you do. You know, you're trained for this. We have years of training to get us to the point where we can do those services. And so you're trained for it. So first of all, you don't panic and you think, right, you've got this, you've totally got this. But then also what you do is you remember that you're a mum. And that particular funeral, the funeral director, I wasn't the parish priest for that person. That funeral director said, I would really like a mum to do this one. So there's something that I could bring, a sensitivity that, not that might be lacking in someone else, but just an authenticity of experience that was needed in that context. You put your big girl pants on, don't you? You do it because that's your job, and because that person needs you, and they need you to be confident and capable and to take as much worry away from them in a hopeless, hideous circumstance. You know, and what are you supposed to say? I mean, that's the other thing. What are you supposed to say to a mum? You know, words fail me even to talk about it now, let alone at the moment of the funeral. So you shut up. You just be quiet and let things just happen. Let the emotion come. And you stand solid and you hold someone's hand and you say, I'm going to sit in this darkness with you for a bit.
Yeah. Well, and what's so good about you, and one of the reasons you're so successful, is that you don't judge, do you? You appear to absolutely accept the place that faith and or religion has in the lives of most people.
Yeah, I think coming from a not particularly religious background, you know, at first when I came to faith, because I came to faith in quite a, you know, sort of conservative evangelical background, really. You know, I was told that if you weren't washed in the blood of the Lamb and you hadn't prayed the prayer, you weren't getting in. You know, so I remember someone telling me as a 14-year-old that my family were going to burn in hell, and it'd probably be my fault because they haven't. And I'm so glad I've grown up. I'm so glad I grew up and changed my mind about a few things. And I think there's a couple of things that we miss about people who are religious, which is that we presume they will always think the same thing forever, which is not true. You know, I change my mind all the time about things. Things I thought, you know, 5 years ago, I don't necessarily believe in the same way now. And I expect that will change again. And I also think that sometimes we think with religion, you've got to buy all of it. You've got to believe every single word of it every single day. And that's just not possible. So if it suits you, if faith suits you for now, it's okay to use it for now.
Okay. Is it all right then to go to a church, not because you believe in the religion or in some aspects of it, but because it's a community and it's a way of meeting people?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I always say to people who've got, you know, they talk about perhaps an older person in their family or their life who's lonely, and I go, well, go to church. You get biscuits and tea. What's not to like? And somehow we might feel guilty about that, but so what? You know, I often used to say when I was a parish priest, I've got enough faith for all of us, so let me believe it. And if you come to a place of believing, that's great. But, you know, often, I mean, let's just look at church buildings for a start. Sometimes in communities, they're the best kept. But they're only used for a couple of hours once a week. That's not right, is it? You know, so they're really good resources. I think that there needs to be an absolution of feeling any faith is there for people to find helpful and useful and to help them grow and, you know, use what you want of it. You don't have to you don't have to like all of it to find something of it useful. And I think that goes for all faiths. You know, I don't just think that's about Christianity. We see it somehow that if we pick and choose that we're somehow doing it a disservice, but I'm confused by that.
That was the Reverend Kate Botley. I really enjoy talking to Kate, and her book is called Have a Little Faith. But I think that conversation illustrates just not only that vicars have real life issues of their own they've got to confront, but that some of the human situations they find themselves in the midst of are, to put it mildly, challenging, Jane. I mean, that was tough, wasn't it? I currently have a vicar in my life, but if I did have, I'd pick one like Kate.
Well, I think you do have a vicar in your life.
Kate's my vicar.
It's
okay.
Kate.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think you could ask for a better one.
No, I don't think you could. Well, it's been lovely having you on Off Air this week.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, no,
I'm going to make up for it all with the Stations of the Cross tomorrow, obviously.
And just find time to buy a colander.
Yeah, and a toaster.
And a toast. Toasters are not expensive. And I think you'll find colanders.
I just clutter up my own kitchen with things I don't use.
Well, get a hook and then, you know, stick it up or
call
ask your dad
art.
To do it.
Call it art.
Call it art. Don't invite men around. Smother yourself in cling film and have a very, very happy couple of days.
How did you know what I was doing this weekend?
I just know too much now. That's the problem. Thank you all for the emails this week. Fee is back next week with Jane. I know that'll be fabulous. And keep the emails coming. Jane and Fee at times.radio. You did it. Elite listener status for you for getting through another half hour or so of our whimsical ramblings, otherwise known as the hugely successful podcast Off Air with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
We missed the modesty class. Our Times Radio producer is Rosie Cutler, the podcast executive producer. It's a man, it's Henry Tribe.
Yeah, he's an executive. Now, if you want even more, and let's face it, who wouldn't, then stick Times Radio on at 3 o'clock Monday until Thursday every week, and you can hear our take on the big news stories of the day, as well as a genuinely interesting mix of brilliant and entertaining guests on all sorts of subjects.
Thank you for bearing with us, and we hope you can join us again on Off Air very soon.